All right. Well, this is a workshop on, what is this workshop on? How to teach students to think. Okay. How to teach students to think. Very good. How many of you have, let's say, in the last week, thought? I mean, thought. How many of you have thought in the last week? Oh, very good. Most of you. Okay. Okay. How many? Yeah, that's right. Thought. For the TH. Okay. What's your answer now?
Yes.
Okay. How many of you have thought in the last day? That's quite impressive. How many of you have thought today? Thomas, what did you think about today? I don't want to know. Anything else? Yes, what did you think about today? About what Katie Kessner had to say. Yes. I have two daughters as well, and my oldest daughter is going to college in the fall for the first time. So it was just really kind of light entertainment for me over lunch. So, Jim, right?
John.
Same alphabet.
It's true.
Have you thought today?
Sometimes.
Really?
What provoked it?
My wife.
Your wife provoked you to think. Well, I was going to ask how, but I don't think I should. George, have you thought today?
I hope so.
Yeah? What did you think about? You thought about what you would put on. How many of you thought about what you would put on this morning when you woke up? A lot of you obviously dressed without thinking. Actually, I did. My wife guesses me. So here we are. Some of you deny that you've thought in the last week. Some of you deny that you thought today. And some of you deny that you thought in the last hour. Is anybody not thinking right now? Good one. I like that. Okay, so why then are we in this room having a discussion about how to teach a child to think when it seems that all of you are thinking right now anyway, and it seems to me that we're always thinking anyway. So why are we talking about teaching a person to think? They're always thinking.
I think it's more about teaching them how to talk about their thoughts.
Oh, sure. Just take over the workshop now and tell me. It's about how to talk about what they're thinking. Okay. How to think in ways that you have never thought before. Can anybody tell me a way that you've never thought before? Or can anybody tell me a way that you think that your kids don't, your students don't think?
I think it goes back to the seeing something in a different light.
Seeing things in a different light? Can somebody go back and get, must have really liked the food?
The logic question just came out of.
Okay.
Where we had to look at the picture and they think differently about what it was conveying and what was the error in what it was.
Was it an Escher? Is it one of those?
No, advertisement.
Advertisement. Okay. Okay.
If you don't come into that logical training, you don't automatically think that.
Okay, so logical training. We can provide logical training that enables us to see things that maybe otherwise we couldn't. Okay, yes?
I think there are different levels of thought.
Different levels of thought?
Not all thoughts are equal.
Ooh.
Wow.
I mean, you know, somebody said, oh, you know, I thought you'd be here an hour ago. And I said, well, I don't know why you thought that. I told you I wasn't coming till tomorrow. I mean, yes, they thought, but it wasn't a very high level of thought. Or it was an incomplete thought. Or a thought that didn't consider all the information, didn't consider all the consequences. So there are different levels of it.
All of a sudden, I had a Forrest Gump flash.
So,
so we can have levels of thought. We can have not enough information. Okay. Okay. Yes.
And semi-related to this, the orderly thought process, where you think of one thing and then you think of the consequence of a lot. What do they call that? A train of thought, I guess. Direction.
Keep the train of thought on the rails. Okay. So we want to teach them to think in a more orderly way. Okay? Yes.
We'd like for them to think proactively as opposed to always thinking in response and reacting.
What
go on about the difference between proactive and reactive.
You asked earlier about what you think about today, and one of my thoughts was, well, what force on this?
Okay.
And you said, what prompted your thoughts? Well, I had a decision.
Ah, okay. A decision. Okay. Decisions require thought, don't they? Okay. So is one of the things that we're trying to, that's proactive?
I think that was reactive.
It was reactive.
I had to consider the forces.
But
if,
that's interesting, because when I took you as talking proactive, because you haven't yet gone, so before you act, you're deciding where to go.
Well, I'm down here getting off the elevator, opening up my
car. I see.
What's in my mind about to walk in?
Okay.
I should have proactively thought
about it. Got it. Okay. Excellent. Thank you, because now I can see. Was it you that talked about incomplete thoughts? And if the thought is incomplete, there's a reactive element. And if the thought is complete, then it's proactive. Can you ever think about something completely ahead of time?
If you've experienced it before. Or if you know what the expectations are.
Can you give me an example?
Well, I guess a simple one of... You know, when you get your first car or something and you run out of gas.
Okay.
Just because you didn't know how far your car could go.
Right. Is Peter Vanderbreek in here?
Or something like that.
I did that in the morning.
But you can, you know, after that's happened to you once, you can begin, now that you know what the consequences are.
Yes.
And you know what your limits are.
Yes.
You can avoid by remembering that experience, that you can think about that in the future. And that now becomes, you know, that new information becomes a determinant, you know, in what you do in the future.
Okay, so now he talked about running out of gas. Just a second. He talked about running out of gas, and what strikes me, because I did actually, we had a board meeting, and Peter Vanderbreek and I very, very generously and kindly and self-sacrificially offered to drive Peter to the airport, and on the way ran out of gas. Because I had a gate that told me I had 20 more miles.
Yeah.
You can imagine the humiliation. And I learned information that I can promise you I sorted in my mind and retained, because we retain information that has an emotional impact, right? Which is, by the way, a good tip for when you're trying to get kids to remember things. So it had this emotional impact that now I can carry with me for the rest of my life as long as I own that car. What strikes me, though, is that there's degrees of completion even. There's complete for the matter at hand, and then there's just complete. Because what I still don't know is whether on the way to the airport my car is going to break down. Right? But I do know enough to make the decision that I am capable of making. Okay. So, thank you. That's very good. You had your hand up.
I was just going to make a comment. Rob Long,
no plan survives risk exposure, right. That's why I'm a big believer in ready, fire, aim. And by that I don't mean be careless. I mean get ready, okay, and then try it, and then you fail forward, okay. And what we're missing, I think, too much in school is we're perfectionists with our kids, and we're requiring them to get it right. And instead of noticing what they do achieve, and sure they fail, but so what? Let's let them fail forward. If you can't make a mistake, Marva Collins once said, or many times said, you can't make anything. And I like to tell kids that first day of school. We're all going to fail together. Okay, let's just all fail together. All right, go ahead. Do something that you fail at. Let's get it started. Ready? Go. All right. But that's life.
we never attain some kind of nirvana, some kind of perfection, some kind of utopian state of perfection. As schools, we need to be continually failing forward. Because if you won't open the school, I know of a city, I can't remember the city now, but anyway, there were two groups of people that wanted to start a Christian classical school in a city, and one of the groups did all kinds of research, and they spent 5 years planning, and they were going to get that thing perfect. 5 years later, there was no school. The other group did a little bit of research, started a school, and now there's a school 5 years later. And it's struggling, but it's there. Right? You see the difference. So, fail forward. What's that got to do with thinking? Anything? Yes? Okay, let the kids fail in their thinking. Good. Let them fail in their thinking. Good. And I would also say that remember what's the context of this discussion. What's the kind of thinking that we're engaged in when we talk about cars running out of gas, getting dressed in the morning, all that sort of thing. What's provoking the thinking is the need to make a what? Decision. How much of your teaching involves kids making decisions? Yeah, a lot. How much of it involves them knowing that they're making a decision for which they're responsible? I do think that's one of the things that's really quite vital, is that if you are thinking, it's because there's something you care about, something you're interested in, something you have to, well, at least one reason is you have to make a decision about something. Okay, that's a practical reason for thinking. And it's quite the incentive. When you bear the responsibility for the outcome of a decision, and when there are actual consequences for the decision, consequences that are immediately felt, it helps us to, it clarifies things. So I would say that whole context of proactive, reactive decision making is really quite an important context. But do you ever think when you don't have a decision to make? You're nodding. Give me an example. Okay, so to understand, not to decide, but to understand. Now, why would you want to understand something if there's nothing you're going to do about it? If you're not going to take that understanding and act on it, why would you want to understand it? So, what satisfaction? What are you talking about?
Contemplation.
Go on.
I want to understand the French government and the Ancien Régime, not because I'm ever going to do anything about that, but simply because I enjoy the
Because you enjoy understanding and contemplating. Okay. You're not going to make a living off it. Okay, so why should somebody's hard-earned money be donated to your school so that you can sit around thinking about the Ancien Régime and start to talk through your nose? And why should somebody else have to pay for a person to sit down and think without a practical outcome?
Lifetime of learning.
But do you know what a burden it is on the economy to have people spending their lifetimes learning? Do you know how hard people have to work for you to sit around thinking? Whereas instead, you could be sitting around watching TV. Who can tell me where the story of Mary and Martha sitting at Jesus' feet is? In the Bible. Okay, good. Good. Now let's narrow that just a little bit. I'm thinking New Testament, Gospels, okay? John. I'll try Luke 10, even though that's not in John. Okay. Martha and Mary, there it is. Thank you. Kudos. Who said that? Thomas. Let's hear it for Thomas. There it is. Now, I want to digress just for a moment and ask you, I had to make a decision there about whether or not I should acknowledge Thomas like that and whether we should clap for him. Was there any practical benefit that anybody derived from that? What was it? How's your self-esteem, Tom? You were embarrassed? Did I undercut it? Are you okay? Are you okay? You'll take the pill? As long as you got meds, everything's okay, right? Yeah, what? Go ahead. Good clarification. Clarification. Good. Okay, so if I'm understanding you, he might have been saying it so that I would find out so that he could confirm that his theory is correct. So he's testing the hypothesis, possibly. Okay. Yes. That's right. Okay, and that gets at it because I'm unfortunately a backfire, but what I was attempting to do is to honor Thomas, okay, and instead what I did apparently was in honoring him I was escaping my own shame, right, and so it's a very common, normal, most of the time our minds are thinking about how we can attain honor and escape shame. I mean, I would go so far as to say that's the basic impulse behind probably most human thinking, most human behavior. So let me read to you these words about Mary and Martha. As they went on their way, Jesus entered a village. And that village, I need to just point out here, is named Bethany, and I need to point that out because that is my future daughter-in-law's name. And a woman named Martha welcomed him into her house. And she had a sister called Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet and listened to his teaching. But Martha was distracted with much serving. And she went up to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to serve alone? Tell her then to help me. But the Lord answered her, Martha, Martha, you are anxious and troubled about many things. But one thing is necessary. Mary has chosen the good portion, which will not be taken from her. Okay, so what does that have to do with what we're talking about?
The good thing is not necessarily the most practical.
Aha. Uh-huh. Good.
And once you have it,
oh, beautiful. Thank you. Good, in other words, and practical are not exact synonyms. Good is better. You can't do better than good. Okay, sometimes practical is good, and sometimes, frankly, it's not. And once you've got the good, our Lord says, it can't be taken away. At least not this good. And what is the good for Mary? The Lord's teachings. Anything practical in his teachings? What do you suppose, if Martha had stopped bustling about and sat down at Jesus' feet, what do you suppose Jesus would have said to her? Any thoughts on that? You know what? It might well be. I've often thought about this, how our Lord says in Matthew 6, he says, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. And of course, as a kid, I'm a young adult anyway, and I married pretty young, and I'm sitting there thinking about this. Well, if I do that, then what about my poor wife? And, you know, I can't attend to all her needs and everything, so... So, you know, I'm trying to reason through this all logically and rationally. I'm trying to ready, aim, fire the whole thing. And then it dawns on me when I was about 40 probably finally that if you actually stop, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness or his justice, and you sit still and listen to him talk, one of the things he's going to say is, love your wife. Okay? He's going to put that right at the top. But if you don't sit down and hear him say that, and if you rush ahead doing it without him saying it, in other words, if you get married without his instruction or whatever, now you've got a problem. Once you're married, he's going to still say it, love your wife. But if you had waited and listened, it would have been pretty practical. But not everything our Lord says is obviously practical. I think of it in parallel this way. I believe it was Fibonacci who came up with the Fibonacci sequence. Anybody know? I think that's right. And my understanding is that he did it just goofing around with numbers. And it wasn't for another 600 or 700 years that somebody found a practical use for that. Isn't that interesting? And the ancient Greeks, they were so excited about true things and beautiful things, they just came up with them. Nobody sat there going, well, what are you going to do with that? They just came up with them. And some of them 5, 6, 700, 1,000 years later, some scientist found some application, like blowing up cities or something. In other words, yeah, truth is incredibly practical, but practicality isn't always truth. But what stands out to me in this context is here's Martha making decisions, acting. And here's Mary listening. And historically, traditionally, the church has often regarded these two as representing two types, two callings. The calling of the contemplative and the calling of the what's the other word? The practical person. The what?
Active.
The active. Yeah, thank you. The active and the contemplative. Thought, in other words, sometimes leads to action, and sometimes leads to truth, leads to knowledge. And you know what? Knowledge is good. It doesn't need to be justified. It doesn't need to be defended. If it's true, good, and beautiful, it's good. Because we don't go through life saying, or our Lord, He didn't say to us, I am the way, the application, and the life. If, therefore, you know truth, you know something about Him. You never, ever, ever, ever need to justify knowing the truth. You do have to work hard to get there, but you never need to justify it. So that leads us in two paths here. It leads us in two directions for thought. Thought that leads to decisions to action, and thought that leads to contemplation of truth. Are they done the same way, or are they done differently? Not pure.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. Is it theoretical? Okay. So Aristotle argued there's practical reason and theoretical reason. Do they work the same way or do they work differently? Anybody? Yes.
We are our society tends to glorify inductive.
Okay. Okay.
As the scientific process far above the deductive.
Excellent. Okay, so what's the difference? Can anybody tell me can anybody tell me what inductive reasoning is? From the particular to the general. Okay. Now, here's the interesting thing about it. We're talking about how to teach children how to think, and I'm going to suggest to you that basically there are two ends of thought. One is knowledge, one is action. Okay? And then I'm going to suggest to you that there's only one order of thinking. I'm going to suggest to you that thinking is amazingly easy. Well, no. I'm going to suggest to you that thinking is amazingly simple. That when we think, we always and only can understand an idea or a universal, which is what we always think about and with. We only can understand an idea when we see the idea embodied. Or if you like, we only can understand the word when the word is made incarnate. And I'm a big advocate, I'm a big fan, if you like, I talk as every chance I get about what I'm beginning more and more to call incarnational teaching. What we have lost in this interestingly hyper-inductive world in which we live, hyper-scientific world in which we live, is the realization that thought is about ideas. Okay? In Philippians 4:8, Paul gives us our curriculum. Yeah, Philippians 4:8. He says, whatever is true and just and noble and honorable and so on. All right, that's our curriculum. So it's the principles behind our curriculum. But how do you teach a child, how do you teach a five-year-old? I'll ask you this question. Should a kindergarten student be thinking about justice? Have you ever asked a kindergarten student to write an essay or have a discussion about justice? How can a kindergarten child think about justice? How? Experience, right? Give them something they want. Don't give them something they want. And that's always not fair. So already they're perverting justice for their own ends. Okay? So why be surprised when... Well, I'll stop there. But what did you say, Lenny? when something's taken away from them. That's never fair either, is it? Okay, now what, that's an opportunity to explain to them maybe some principles, but if we're going to teach them about justice, can you sit down and give them a lecture on justice and effectively perform, achieve much? Tell them a story. Yeah. Barbara Tuchman, she had a real simple solution to teaching history. Tell stories. Right? And I would argue that the power of story is let me put it this way. If you stop and contemplate story for 5 minutes a day for the rest of your life, you will never come close to exhausting its power. The story comes first. Western civilization did not begin with a philosophical treatise. It began on the fields of Ilium, and in the tents outside the battlefield, where Achilles had a fit. Okay. Western civilization began in the stories of Homer. All Greek philosophy, every Greek discovery, is rooted in Homer. All of it, and the Christian elements, the Christian. The sovereign Christian influence over Western history did not begin with the giving of the law, which happened in Exodus 20. It began with narrative, which begins in Genesis 1. This is the generation of Adam. This is the generation of Noah. This is the generation of Abraham. This is the generation of, I forget, is it Isaac next? But there's a cycle of seven narratives, stories about people, about human beings. And then finally, after 69 chapters, the Lord descends and gives abstract principles. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet. All of that has already been played out in page after page after page of Genesis. The catechism, you might say, comes after the story. And the catechism doesn't mean anything without the story. God is first and foremost personal. Thinking is therefore first and foremost personal. Maybe I should even say interpersonal. God is triune. Thinking takes place in relationships. Joseph Pieper said something along the lines of the atmosphere of truth is communication, or the domain of truth is communication. Truth can't be known apart from communication. So if I had one thing to sort of summarize everything about teaching children how to think, I would put it this simply. Communicate with them. Talk with them and listen to them. That's how we learn to think. And in the course of that, tell and listen to stories. Okay. So stories, you might even go so far as to say stories, well, stories are certainly what makes thinking interesting. Right? You're not going to get an Aristotle or a Thomas Aquinas or a Basil the Great if you don't first have a whole bunch, if you don't fertilize the moral imagination with great stories. Thomas Aquinas wouldn't have the foggiest idea what he was talking about if he hadn't been reading all kinds of fairy tales. You see? And why is that? Because stories embody. They incarnate abstract ideas. The point is that we come to understand, we come to understand ideas, generalizations, by seeing them incarnate, by seeing them in concrete terms, by seeing examples. When a speaker gets up and says something very confusing to you, what would be the first question that goes through your mind? Give me an example. Right? See, thinking is simple. It's simple. We're confused, so we want an example. And then what we do is we look at these examples, we compare them with each other, and then we come to understand an idea. If our hearts are pure, then we'll look at these examples, we'll compare them with each other rightly, and we'll draw the right conclusion. And if we draw the wrong conclusion and our hearts are pure, in other words, our will is not distorted by sinister appetites, okay, then we will interpret the comparisons and come to the truth. Okay. So as I said at lunch, for which I apologize, I don't apologize for this. I apologize for the joke that I goofed up. But what was I about to say?
You said at lunch. You
was anybody listening at lunch? What did I talk about? You weren't there?
The problem with the organ.
The health of the, yeah, the health of the soul. Right, thank you. Purity of heart comes first, okay? If we don't have purity of heart, then nothing, you know, no thinking works. Because our appetites are misdirected. Right? But if our heart is pure, then when we see the information, we'll interpret it rightly. Okay? When we see the examples, the embodiments, we'll interpret it rightly. So the first thing is the pure heart. Yes?
An example to clarify that. There was a teacher who had a class.
Sorry, can everybody hear George?
The teacher had a class, and they were teaching trying to instill character, and this was an urban school, and they had focused on courage and respect, and discussed it and defined it, and he wanted to really bring us alive through story, and he brought out a Sports Illustrated, these were boys, so he wanted to really make it relevant, so he brought out a Sports Illustrated and read the story, an old story, about Latrell Sprewell, who's an NBA basketball player, and he got into he was at practice, the coach yelled at him, got really mad at him, and he ended up storming off, and then the player came back out of the locker room and punched the coach, knocked him down, and he wanted the kids to interpret that through the lens of courage and respect. And to them, they said, the coach showed disrespect by yelling at him, and the player showed courage by coming and punching the coach. And totally
you're the wrong application.
Wrong application. But again, it fits the community in which they lived in, because that was their story that was more real to them than what he was trying to teach in an abstract way. It was really interesting how their cultural context actually distorted his ideal of what he was trying to teach. So it's really
That's right. And here's the thing. I do, for example, I believe in teaching ethics through fables. Aesop's fables. So I'll do fables with kids or even with adults when I do in-house teacher training. And sometimes, well, with adults it's pretty safe. But every now and again with a child, they'll draw the wrong conclusion. For example, the ass's shadow is a fable I like to use a lot. If you know it, this youth rents an ass to ride from Athens to Megara. On the way, it's too hot, so he gets off. And the driver and the youth fight about the shadow of the ass, in which the youth is trying to rest. And while they're fighting, the ass runs away. I love to use that because it's so much fun watching evangelicals get permission to use the word ass for the first time. Ever since we got rid of the King James, you know. But what if a child draws the conclusion that, or an adult draws the conclusion that if you want to get the shadow, you better get there fast and make sure you prevent the other guy from getting near it. Right? You better fight for it or position yourself. In other words, what if they take an entirely political, power hunger, self-defensive approach to the shadow instead of learning that sharing is useful? What if they take the position of either the youth or the driver? Okay. Now, you have a purity of heart issue there. Okay? But then the question becomes, do you have the power to purify their hearts? Certainly not, but you can be an instrument in the hand of God to move them in the direction of purity of heart. And that's where thinking can help us. It can help us. We are to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. So our thinking can be purified, if you like. And in that case, one thing you can do that has no guarantees, but if there's anything of the Spirit and grace of God in them, they might get it if you make another comparison. Sorry, if you tell them another story that doesn't allow for that same conclusion. And you do that now without telling them, by implication, you foolish boy, you missed the point, you're so bad. Instead, you affirm them, you treat them with respect, and you acknowledge their right to think. Not only that, but their responsibility to think, by giving them another story. And you do it not shocked because that they're sinful, right? But accepting the fact that just like you, they're sinful. So they're going to misinterpret some things, and they need some very careful instruction. But the basic point I'm getting at is the simplicity here is that we look at concrete types, we look at examples, we look at pictures, we look at metaphors, we listen to parables, we listen to stories, and from those concrete living instances, we make comparisons and we draw conclusions. That's how you learned what red was when you were a little child. That's what you learned what a carpet was, and a dog versus a cat, and a book versus a magazine. And the more closely things are related, the more comparison and the more time it takes. But that's it. Literally, that's it. If you look at particulars, you compare them with each other, which your mind can't help doing once you start looking at particulars, you will draw conclusions about universal ideas. And a universal idea is not some fancy philosophical thing. Red is a universal idea. Okay? All right, that's philosophical. Peace. Right? Justice, the American way. Okay, these are universals. They can only be understood when you see them, when you experience them. So, it is imperative that we be presenting to our students types. And I use the word types because it's the broadest usage. It can be a model. And do you see, as soon as I say model, how all of a sudden the curriculum expanded? How it's not just about reading books and controlling thinking? It's not a mind control. Remember the Pink Floyd song? When that came out, I was in high school and pious, you know, going through a pious stage, and I was kind of offended by it. In retrospect, I recognized it in the context into which they were singing. They were quite right. We don't need no education. We don't need no mind control. So much mind control taking place in schools. We're supposed to be training minds. You put it in a cage, the mind is confined. Imagine that. But if we treat it purposefully and we train it to, if we refine the operations of the mind, then that person can think better. So, basically, all I've said so far is a simple thing, that if you want a person to understand an idea, then give them instances and examples and types and pictures of that idea, contemplate them together, and when you're done, they'll understand it better than they did when you started. Okay, and that's the inductive method. Now, mode. You've also probably heard of the other ductive. Anybody know? There's inductive and then there's what? Deductive. So does that contradict everything I've just said? Not really. What I'm arguing is that once you've drawn a deduction, once you've concluded something, once you know a concept, and you've internalized and become conscious of the understanding, then you can draw out particular applications of that concept. Right? So thinking then is climbing a hill and skating down, climbing another hill and skating down. Thinking is a cycle of induction and deduction, induction and deduction. And that means coming to understand an idea and then using it. So if you want to teach a child to think, the best thing you can do is get them in the habit of coming to understand ideas and using them. I think, like everything, this is most easily exemplified in math. If you want to watch the mind work as a pure mind, find the way math is supposed to work. I don't mean the way a kid struggles, but if you want to watch the way the human mind works in the most abstract, in other words, you can see it working without all the human variables, you know, society and circumstances, watch how a child learns math. The only trouble is you can't watch how a child learns math with most modern math curricula because they're rooted in Deweyite notions of math as unstable things knowing unstable things, as opposed to a stable mind knowing a universal permanent reality. Okay. In other words, 9 to us is 9. Never was anything else, never will be anything else. And it doesn't just exist in the mind, it exists in the fabric of the universe. But modern education doesn't believe that, so it teaches math differently, and the more it teaches math differently, the less kids understand math. But if you want a child to understand math, don't want to be crass here in this, but it's not that hard. Certainly not complex. There's a concept you want them to understand, and that concept might be as simple as first you add the ones column, then you add the tens column. And if you show them that repeatedly, bring them into the process of thinking about that, they will make the comparisons, and when they finish the process, they will be able to explain to you that first you add the ones column, then you add the tens column. They've just gone through types. You've given, you know, you put them on the board and you model it, and they've gone through types. Every math teacher does this, whether they're conscious of it or not. This is the way they end up doing it. And when the child's stuck, what do they fall back on? More examples, right? Because that's what they need. So you give example, 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 example. Every time you give an example, the child compares them. Now what you want to do is then help the child compare them. Don't say, I did this here and I did this there. Ask, what did I do here and what did I do here? What did I do first both times? What did I do first all three times? What did I always do the same thing first? What did I do the same first every time? And then they see it. They come to understand the idea. And then you give them the worksheet because they now understand the idea. They can now apply it. Right? Very simple. Now, of course, when you get to calculus, it's not that easy. But it is that simple. In other words, you still have to take the concept and embody it and let them contemplate it until they get it. That's why geometry isn't taught in math programs very often around the world nowadays, because geometry is an entirely contemplative class. Nothing will teach kids to contemplate like geometry. That's why Simone Weil said geometry is a great way to learn how to pray. Because when you pray, I don't know if you've ever noticed this, you're the one praying. Okay? When you pray, if you're undisciplined, you will be undisciplined when you pray. When you pray, if you're controlled by, if you're driven around by distractions, you will be driven around by distractions when you pray. If you can't enter into the silence and stay there, then when you pray, you won't be able to enter into the silence and stay there. Geometry forces all of that on you. And I would urge you, therefore, to lift geometry to the highest level of your math program. Not necessarily teaching it last, but it's the most important math that you'll teach, apart from just arithmetic. So we've got these two streams. We've got thinking to apply and thinking to think, thinking to know and thinking to act. And we've got these two movements of thought. We've got movement from the particular to the universal through comparing, and then we've got the applying the universal, which is moving from the universal to the particular. And just to clarify, in the math assignment we talked about, you give them the worksheet after they understand the idea. And now it's pretty easy to do the worksheet, but if it's not, you can figure out why, because all you have to do is say to the child who's stuck, can you tell me how we do this? And if he can't, you go back and give more examples. And you keep doing that cycle until they get it. Now, the other thing is, and this is a really critical point, what I'm describing for you right now is thought in the abstract, which is to say decontextualized, apart from circumstances, thought as it happens in the brain. Okay? But thought is done by human beings. And human beings are personal, thus the importance, as we said earlier, of stories. So a critical element of teaching a child to think is that you have to arouse interest. Now, John Milton Gregory gives a great principle in this regard. You have to arouse interest. What is a child, what does all new knowledge need to stick? Connected to prior knowledge, right? Facts, which are your concrete examples for the most part, facts don't like to be alone. So they walk into the room of your brain, they look around, and they see if there's anybody else they know there. And if there is, they walk up and say hi, and they stick around. If there's not, they leave, unless you force them to stay. You see? Facts are lonely. They need friends. They're just like us. Okay? And so, therefore, in the act of teaching a child how to think, there are things that you can do to personalize the thinking, and that doesn't mean to get outside the context of the subject that you're in, necessarily. It simply means find out what's already in the mind. Find out what they already know. Staying in math. If I'm going to do two-column addition, what happens if my kids don't know what the plus sign means? Or that line under the equation? Or what 7 plus 2 is? In other words, if they know those things, two-column addition is very simple. Tiny little adjustment. If they don't, there's no hope that they can learn it. And therefore, before you start presenting the types to engage them in thinking, I encourage you to ask questions about what they already know about what you're about to teach them. Because here's the thing. Once they discover how much they already know, they're ready to connect new things to it, and their confidence is improved. That's in the math context, but what if I'm going to do the ask a shadow story? Well, I ask questions like this. Has anybody here ever been to Greece? Now, that's mostly adults, of course, but I'll ask, has anybody ever been to Greece? Has anybody ever ridden a donkey? If not, has anybody ever ridden a horse? If so, has anybody ridden a horse, and how are they alike and different? Has anybody been in a fight recently? What did you fight about? Who won? Did you lose what you were fighting over or get it? Right? In other words, personal questions that relate to the story. And by the way, that's a fabulous way to prepare for Greek history, because the next thing you read after the Ass's Shadow is the Iliad, and you say, has anybody ever been in a fight before? Has anybody ever been angry? By the way, getting in fights and being angry, that's a really common thing in life. And therefore, if you can deal with people at that level, they'll be interested in what you're talking about. And that's what great literature does over and over and over again. So if you can find what they already know, you've aroused their interest, and now they're ready for the discussion. But if there's one tool that enables you to think more than any other tool, what would you say it is? Sorry, that enables you to teach somebody else to think more than any other tool. What do you think is the tool par excellence for getting another person to think? Question, right? Question. If you can ask questions and you can tell stories, you can get people to think. Are you more alert when you're being lectured to or being asked questions? Now, if I were to have said at the beginning of this lecture, you are more alert during lectures than when people ask you questions, and then proceeded to lecture you for 50 minutes. If I knew the tricks of classical rhetoric, or just knew how to weave stories and all that kind of thing, and play all the rhetorical games, I probably could have held your interest. We all like a good comedian, which I'm not, but you can follow somebody along who's entertaining you. But it's not really making you think in the same way, is it? So the key I would suggest to you to teaching a child to think is quite simply, one, ask them questions, and two, give them something high and noble and lofty to think about. Okay. And that's why the great books, the great works of art, the great music, that sort of thing. And I'll give you five questions that I have found to be enormously powerful. If you want more detail on these questions, they're in the inside front cover of Edward P.J. Corbett's Classical Rhetoric for the Modern Student, and they are the invention process used in the Lost Tools of Writing. I already embarrassed you once, so I was thinking I'll call you up and see if you know them, but I won't do it. The first question is, what do you mean? Let me list them as topics. I'll give you five words and then explain them very briefly because we need to end. The first one is definition. Second one is comparison. Third one is circumstances. Definition, comparison, circumstances, relations, and authority. Classical Academic Press has an argument builder book that has these on the inside front cover of that book as well. Okay, definition, comparison, circumstances, relationship, authority. Now, definition simply means, what is that, who is that, what do you mean by that? You don't need to write all those down because you'll remember when you have to do it. Comparison means, how is that alike, how is that different, degree, kind, all that sort of thing. By the way, once you've asked the question, how is that alike, how are those alike, and how are they different, you've now got a discussion that can last for the rest of your life. You'll never have writer's block again if you use that. Circumstances. What was going on at the time? What's the context? And relations, I'm going to come back to that. And authority, who says what about it? Experts, witnesses, encyclopedias, references, who has something to say about this? But I want to come back to relationships because this is the magic category. The ultimate question that you want to be asking constantly, that you want to habituate your students toward asking, and believing that there are answers to, is the question they're asking all the time anyway. Why? And there are four ways to answer the question, why? What is it made out of? What is its purpose? Two parts, the agent and instrument. Who brought it into being and how, which I'm going to consider one. And what is the idea? Everything that exists, when you ask the why question, you're basically asking those four questions. If I want to know about this overhead, why is this overhead here and why is it like it is, I would have to explore all four parts of this. If I look at a child and I want to know why he's goofing around right now, I have to ask all four of those questions. What is it made out of? Could there be a chemical imbalance? Could he have missed breakfast? okay, sometimes. What's the idea behind it? What patterns were established for him that he is imitating? What is his purpose? This one's hard to get at, isn't it? But I'll say this in regard to his purpose. There's some honor he's after. Okay, what honor is he seeking? And why is he using this perverse way to do it? How can I give it to him without giving in to the perversion? Okay. And what acted on him to lead to this behavior? Environment, friends, relationships. But you can't take any one of those and have a thorough answer. The behaviorist is asking, what did the environment do? The humanist is asking, sorry, I shouldn't use humanist, that's too vague. The Freudian is asking, what's he made out of, what forces are acting within him? The medical doctor is saying, what chemicals are out of whack? And the theologian is asking, where is his will going? We need to always be asking, what's his purpose? And we need to be asking, what models is he imitating? Okay? So that's a side application of how we also can think better if we have the right categories. Because the last thing I'll say, we've got stories and questions. The third and final thing I'll add as a tool of thinking is categories of thought. Categories of thought, like justice, truth, goodness, beauty, freedom, ideas. If your ideas are empty or don't respond to reality, you can think with great skill but not find the truth, and eventually you fall into despair, and you bring up the next generation who doesn't believe in thinking. But if you believe in truth, then you use categories of thought that reveal truth, that expose the child to it, to help them interpret it, help them make decisions, and best of all, help them sit at the feet of our Lord and just contemplate what he's saying. So it's a great and high and noble responsibility we're given. Don't shirk it. Thank you.